New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos. You can now download a free PDF copy or purchase a beautiful printed edition of Issue 5 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlov.
Hello and welcome. I'm Emmy Vadnais, co-host with Jeffrey Mishlov. Today we'll be exploring the topic of cultural astronomy with my guest Allison Chester Lambert, who has a master's degree in cultural astronomy, astrology, and mythology. She was the founder of the UK Midlands School of Astrology and the former resident astrologer for a daily BBC TV news show. She is author of Starry Messengers, Future in the Stars, and The Easy Way to Learn Astrology, How to Read Your Birth Chart. She has also created astrology reading cards, and Greek mythology reading cards. If you enjoy this program, please like, subscribe, press the bell icon, and share. Allison is located in Leicestershire, England. Now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Allison. It's a joy to be with you on New Thinking Aloud today.
Thank you. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
Today, we're going to be exploring cultural astronomy. What exactly is that topic all about?
Well, there's a really simple sort of in a nutshell explanation, and I'll give you that straight off. So it's to do with how much the sky has influenced cultures throughout history. And that's it. So if we just take the sky and the study of the sky as astronomy, now, we'll just have to separate off astronomy and astrology here to start with. An astronomer looks at the sky and goes, look at all that pattern, look at all that stuff, that's really interesting. An astrologer looks at the sky and goes, look at those patterns, look at all that stuff, that's really interesting. That has meaning. The astronomer doesn't attach any meaning to the same patterns and planets that the astrologer looks at. And that really is a difference. And if we just go back in history, really, right from the year, well, let's go to prehistory. So before the Babylonians. So we're looking at 6000 BC, something like that. And then coming forward, there used to be a race, I've just mentioned the Babylonians, who used to do the most incredible empirical studies on the planets. And there are thousands of clay tablets with all of these studies on the planets. So when they say it's not science, well, that's science. And the Chinese did the same. They were desperate to understand eclipses and when eclipses were coming and that kind of thing. So it is as old as that. And when we start to get towards the turn from BCE to AD, it's called astrologia at this point. And astronomy and astrology are exactly the same. In fact, they remain astrologia right up to pretty much the 17th and 18th century, when the coming scientific revolution made the difference, because what the science revolution wanted to do, of course, was get rid of magic. So everything to do with that was incorporeal, couldn't be understood, couldn't be repeated in an experiment, let's say, that had to out the door with all the rest of the whimsical divination and foretelling of the future. And that's when it sort of split up into astrology and astronomy. So cultural astronomy is an astronomy that means you look at the sky and how did that affect cultures? How did it affect their storytelling? How did it affect their worshipping, their beliefs, in God or not or whatever.
Can you share an example in history of when people looked up into the night sky and saw patterns that reflected what was happening in society and culture at that time?
Rushing to my tongue is so many examples. I think we're going to have to go to Egypt, aren't we? Because Egypt is such a fascinating subject for everybody. And they left us so many clear records. We are only just getting cultural astronomers into those tombs and temples now alongside the Egyptologists. And the Egyptologists are so grateful that the cultural astronomers are there because they understand the mechanics of astronomy. Now, okay, they do tend to be astrologers on the side, but there is a tradition for astrologers to be, for astrology to be a subject on the side. Galileo was an astrologer on the side. We can come look at Carl Jung, the Swiss psychiatrist. He was an astrologer on the side, as was Freud. But anyway, so an example. So what they would do in the temples in Egypt is they were clever enough to know exactly where the sun was on the other side of the planet during the night. These were mathematicians of an incredibly advanced nature. They could build a pyramid to the exact cardinal points of east, south, north and west, just by sticking something in the sand and working out shadows and things like this. I think they calculated the circumference of the earth to the nearest, you know, few hundred miles or something. And they used the stars and the rotation of the stars and the arc of the stars, etc., to do amazing calculations. But most of all, what they needed to do was support the sun. So the sun and the sun god intermeshed. The sun was a god, and that was it. It was a solar state as far as having a religion, which was completely based on solar worship. And they had to protect that god as he went through the underworld, which was full of snakes and adversaries. And so they needed to know where he was, the sun was, at every second, so that they could support that journey in that particular place. And and the priests would be accompanied by musicians and all kinds of scribes and this, that and the other. I can tell you a fantastic story about the people of Haran, old Haran. So I was actually down in South Turkey, very close to the Syrian border, looking for Göbekli Tepe, the world's oldest temple, as it was called, the world's oldest temple. That for me is a silly title because it's only the world's oldest temple till we find another one. it's the one we found. So anyway, I needed to get pictures of Göbekli Tepe because ISIS were very close to the border in Syria, and I wanted to see this place before it got overrun or possibly raided. And so it was great. I went with my partner. Thank goodness he came because I would have wanted to go on my own. But just a little way along at the border in Turkey was ancient Haran. And I wanted to go and see this place because I'd heard about these caves with various architectural and drawings and cave art and stuff and everything. We came into really beautifully untouched biblical scenes. Villagers who had all their beds were built on stilts, and they were always outside their houses. I don't think their houses had much of a roof anyway, but the bed was outside. And all of them would sleep in that bed, raised up, and all the animals would be put underneath for the night. And they would lie there and they would spend their night as a family looking at the stars and obviously discuss it was like Coronation Street or one of the soap operas to them. Sorry, mentioning an English soap opera there. But it was like looking at a soap opera on television, or the television in general. And so they were deeply embedded in the cultural astronomy, the observation of the stars and the constellations and the planets. And that was just in an amateur way, lying there on their beds and gazing up at the stars in southern Turkey. There you go.
And they discovered patterns in the sky that reflected what was happening within their culture, their society, and also for their personal lives.
What they're doing is they're just local villagers looking up and talking amongst themselves, really. But when you start to get those observations and there are comparisons being made to events on Earth and the position of one of those space objects, then you start to get an interest in, well, that's funny, because the last time Venus rose or disappeared for the 40 days, etc., this happened, and now this is happening again. You very slowly start to get meaning to the patterns or the movement of the heavenly bodies.
Can you share a little bit more about Galileo and their discoveries and how that might have impacted, or how it did impact, society and culture?
I think we devolved knowledge at one point, actually, because there is a papyrus called the Diverni Papyrus, which quotes a sage, it quotes the fact that the sun is at the center and the planets around the outside of the sun. Now, this is about 500 BC. Now, it was at that point that they were supposed to think that we had a geocentric cosmos. So geocentric meaning an earth-centered, heliocentric meaning a solar-centered. So that puts the sun at the center, heliocentric. How did we then get to a geocentric, which we did for several hundred years after that? I think actually there was quite a lot of opposition to the sun being at the center because of the growing supporters of the Catholic religion in Italy, which tended to want the earth to be in the middle, because that put Rome in the middle and the Catholic Church in the middle. And so there was great support for that, the importance of Rome and the Catholics. And so I think we get religion really skewing it a little. But we also seem to go in and out of knowledge at that point. We lost knowledge, we gained it again. I can't remember the exact name of the particular astronomers or astrologers and who said what, but there was debate about heliocentric or geocentric all the way through. It was the Catholic Church that were absolutely adamant that the earth was at the center. And let's face it, they're paying for all the art. So if they're paying for the art, then, you know, you're not going to be stupid enough display the wrong thing, are you? You kind of got to say the earth's at the center. And so that's what was happening in Italy, certainly.
And so then what happened to culture when there was no going back, that really we did move around the sun?
We're talking about the 17th century. By then, the scientists, if you like, or the academics, had gotten just too good at the measuring. And they have these lovely models of the solar system, so they can predict conjunctions and things. And they had had to do some quite substantial meddling in order to get these things to work if the Earth was going to be at the center. And probably secretly, you know, they all had a sun-centered model somewhere, and they were going, yeah, that's the one, but we can't say anything because we'll be beheaded. But eventually they got to the point where you just can't deny this stuff. This model works, this one doesn't. That was it.
Yeah. And so then that shifted our culture in various ways.
I think by that point, people were more interested in who was ruling them and the taxes they had to pay, and were they going to be able to plant their corn? You know, I think there was always, for your average person, much more pressing stuff to do with survival. So I think astronomy, astrology, I think Astrologia, let's say, it tended to be a subject for those who could read and write and for those who could pay for it. And so it was always about the people in court or the people at the top, the hierarchy, the priests, the priestesses, or religion, you know, that kind of thing, I think.
You've used the term astrologia a few times. Can you share a little bit more about
that? Yeah, that's what it used to be called. Before the separation, the astronomy and astrology were the same subject, and it was called astrologia.
How does cultural astronomy intersect with religion or spiritual practices?
Right. Now, it depends on the epoch. let's take some cultural astronomy. An example has just popped into my head, and it's to do with Easter Island. Actually, I actually had to go to Easter Island in 2015. I was enormously lucky to be able to visit the island because I was interested in the island which had given the deity's name to a newly discovered dwarf planet, Maki Maki. So I wanted to go and see this island. Now, Maki Maki was awarded with the amazing gift of being able to tell them when they were going to eat seafood and when they were going to eat crops. Now, if you're sitting on an island and it's 11 miles by 8 miles, it's incredibly important to know whether or not you're going to be eating tuna all year or you're going to be putting your precious potatoes in the ground. If it doesn't rain, then those potatoes aren't going to survive. You haven't got any more. So life or death subject here. So say we don't put the potatoes in the ground and then there's no abundance in the sea, then again, we're in trouble, right? So the priests of Maki Maki used to be able to pontificate on this. They would have a ceremony and they would say what the people had to do. This was all sort of myth, really. But then some science stepped in. Now this was on the coast of South America. And I'm pressed to tell you who did the actual research. I'm afraid I haven't got the name in my head. But they studied a race of people who would look at the brightness of the Pleiades at a certain time of the year. So a Pleiades is a cluster of dim stars at a certain time of the year. And according to its brightness, they would plant potatoes or they would fish because it meant that the weather was going to turn a certain way. Right? Now, it turns out, looking at it now with hindsight, that this was about the southern oscillation, the La Nina El Nino southern oscillation. So now I'm not going to get this the right way around. I hope I do. But when La Nina was prevalent, then the warmer waters would come up from the bottom of the sea. there would be a feeding frenzy and there was an abundance of seafood that would have been available around Easter Island in the same way. When it was an El Nino year, there was going to be lots of rain and therefore the crops were going to provide the food and the fish were going to sink down. Now, there's cultural astronomy at work that just, and it turns out that the dimness and the brightness of the Pleiades is to do with some atmospheric thing that was happening that was announcing the coming southern oscillation, which bit they were in. And so it's probably things like that that have fed a cultural knowledge or belief in a god who provided them with his, you know, his graciousness, awarded them with abundance because they prayed to him. The deities tend to be what that population needs them to be. And so that's how a cultural astronomy was working with the belief system of human beings.
You are also an expert in the dwarf planets, and there have been some recent discoveries. In fact, Pluto used to be a planet and got demoted several years ago. Can you share a little bit about what was going on in culture around that time?
Wow, absolutely. For me, this is a fascinating subject. When we discover planets, it tends to be at a time when populations are going through certain big upheavals. Now, you know, we can believe that or believe it not. It doesn't matter either way. But the story is that Uranus was discovered just before the French Revolution, right? So it's that kind of stuff.
Can you say a little bit more about what Uranus has to do with a revolution? And because some people may not know the meaning of that planet.
Yeah, sure. So according to astrologers, Uranus has a revolutionary nature. It's all about uproar, breakdown, breakthrough, breakup. It tends to strike in a very revolutionary way. So revolution being sort of evolution, which works on a fast pace.
Right. Thank you for that.
Yeah. So the turn of this millennium, so there was a group of people working at Caltech who got involved with a Palermo survey. And this was to survey the outer solar system looking for planet X. Now, this mysterious planet X, there's a lot of mythology and stories, current mythology and stories about planet X. I mean, you put planet X into Google and you have an explosion of theories about planet X. However, as far as I'm concerned, there is a planet X out there because the actual orbit of Neptune tells us there is a tugging, and so there is something out there, and we have yet to discover it. However, it was thought that if we use this really very big telescope, then we would be able to discover it. So, what had happened previously was that all of the searches for planets had been on the ecliptic. Now, the ecliptic is kind of like a fried egg. So the yolk in the middle is the sun, and then you've got that flat white bit. And all the planets orbit on that plane. Okay. So whenever anybody had looked for planet X, it had been on that plane. And then there was an idea. Okay, so what if we look off that plane and see if there's any planets anywhere else? Well, how could there be? Because the very rules of how a solar system develops is all about sort of whizzing matter and how it coalesces and everything. Never mind, let's look off the ecliptic. So they looked off the ecliptic. So they're looking up here and down here now. And they discovered planets. In fact, they discovered loads of planets, lots of stuff. So it turns out that we've got a nice orderly solar system here, right up until Neptune. And then after Neptune, we have this absolute chaos, which if you were to get outside the solar system and look back, then it would look like a bee's nest. it's all wild. So they had great fun discovering all of, well, planets, genuine planets, really. And I say genuine planets because, and we hadn't really thought about this before, there wasn't even an official definition for the word planet. There never needed to be one. Because as we discovered one more, then it was a planet. Of course it was. And that was it. So change the school books. The problem was with the amount of planets they were discovering was that there's only so many school books you can keep reprinting, and they were discovering them at a phenomenal rate. And so somebody sensibly probably worked in an education department somewhere and had the budget, went, no, stop, that's it. You can't keep adding planets like this. And so we have to have another system. We have to, first of all, agree what a planet is, and then we have to agree whatever it is we're discovering here. Well, it kind of worked, really, to look at the planets as being the ones that were just on that plane, on that flat plane up to Neptune. That it looks sensible. And when you kind of look at it, you think, well, that's neat and tidy. Because all the others are just off the ecliptic, these bees everywhere. So the bees are in what we call the Kuiper Belt. And so they decide that anything in the Kuiper Belt was not a planet, it was a dwarf planet. Now, they developed some actual rules for this, hydrostatic equilibrium and all these rules and things. And it had to have cleared its orbit of debris, all this sort of stuff. But in actual fact, it just seems sensible, really. Well, they're planets because like that, and the other things are dwarf planets because they're like that. But then one of these dwarf planets is actually in the asteroid belt, which is well within the orbit of all the smaller planets. So we've got the way it goes is you've got Mercury, Venus, Earth with the Moon, Mars, and then you've got the asteroid belt, and then you've got Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune. Ceres in the asteroid belt has the properties to be a dwarf planet, not an asteroid. So she has dwarf planet status, and that kind of changes the dwarf planet thing. Well, okay, so we thought that everything trans or past Neptune, so trans-Neptunian objects, was dwarf planets. Well, they're not, because there's one in the asteroid belt, but anyway. Pluto then had to be disengaged from mainstream thought in terms of planet, because it doesn't sit on that main ecliptic. And so that's why Pluto had to, as a planet, had to be demoted to dwarf planet. Now, is it a demotion? For me, no, because I think the dwarf planets are much more interesting than Mars. Originally, Mike Brown and the team discovered Makemake, Haumea. Now, you can hear from what I'm saying, the names sound strange. These newly discovered objects haven't got the names of Greek or Roman gods.
Like the previous planets.
Yeah, like it's always been, because the IAU, the International Astronomical Union, this sort of roughly had this sort of thing about, yeah, well, if it's a really important discovery, then give it the name of a Roman or Greek god. I don't know why, it was just something they were doing. Nobody ever really thought about it before. You know, they've got a department for discovering things, right? And so all the maths and the geometry and everything has to go to this department to be looked through. there was probably two people half asleep in this department, and there had been for 50 years. So you can imagine. So suddenly there's like, okay, what do you mean there's 10 new planets? What do you mean there's 15 new planets? What do you mean there's 20 new planets? It's like, wake up. They probably had to employ somebody else. Anyway, so strange names. And it was because the main discoverer, Mike Brown, was determined that he would break away. He was a maverick, by the way. This is one maverick astronomer. He upsets everybody. I love him. So he decided that why should the center of the world, the center of the solar system, be Rome and Greece for names? This is crazy. We've got a whole world here with loads of deities we can pick. So he chose the names of deities from the Pacific. So a goddess from Hawaii, a god from Maki Maki, except from Easter Island, called Maki Maki. And what a brilliant idea. And also Kwawa, which I can never say, was the god in California before the Western people got there, and etc. And he was an amazing guy, I'll put it like that. And his wife was pregnant at the time, and he wanted, because he was going home and he was holding his wife tummy and feeling the baby move at night, and he was so in awe of this amazing creation that he wanted to name dwarf planets after deities who were about creation, creating babies or creating land or creating life. And so he did that, and he did it with great passion. But he also did it just by Googling. He didn't do it academically. He Googled. I was in touch with him at the time. We were exchanging emails because I was writing a book about his discoveries. And I just thought that was amazing. So you Google, you discovered a planet, you Google, and you give it a name like that. Wow. And he didn't even keep a record of the Google. So there we go. So that's why we have Maki Maki, a creator god from Easter Island, and Haumea, a creational goddess from Hawaii.
Was he involved with Ceres?
The asteroid Ceres is a dwarf planet, yes. No, he didn't name that. The asteroid was named in 1801.
Yeah, a long time ago. But that was also, it's also a nurturing heavenly body as well, right?
She is, yes. Yeah, Ceres is, she is the archetypal mother, really. And the mother, the maiden, the old crone, the death, and the rebirth. She's the whole cycle of the feminine cycle of mum having a baby, and then baby grows and then becomes a mum, etc. Yeah, the cycle, the feminine cycle.
You go into a lot of detail about Easter Island and Maki Maki. Is there anything you want to share about your research into that today?
I think this goes for all of Mike Brown's choices. What he's given us is symbols of reflection for when mankind has been utterly thoughtless, very cruel, and really these are not the finest moments. So Easter Island, for instance, has a terrible history. And at one point, they went down to 101, the population of 101. And this was because of the amount of traveling that the Europeans were doing in an effort to colonize distant lands and take, well, rob them, really, of anything useful, resources. And so the Europeans were all getting on their boats and going into the South Pacific and taking with them all of the European bugs and infections, passing them to the local people who had absolutely, no way of defending their immune systems and never come across these. And so they decimated and wiped out a lot of the population. The ones they hadn't, they dropped off representatives of the Catholic Church, missionaries, whose job it was to destroy all of the indigenous artifacts, art, any existing examples of temples and religious beliefs. So that all had to be destroyed, torn down, burnt, and they were, and in place they were all to follow Christianity. And my goodness, those missionaries and priests have a lot to answer for as well. On Easter Island, the Easter Islanders had always had a very colourful and robust sexual attraction to each other, and it was part of Maki Maki, actually, that when their numbers were down, Maki Maki called on them to copulate. So that was, they went about that with gusto, apparently.
Maki Maki being the spirit of the island, the god, goddess. How would you describe Maki Maki?
To them, he was a god, and to them, he assisted in generation, procreation. So if they needed more population, he would assist in procreation. If they needed more food, if they needed more abundance, if they needed more seafood, he would provide. He was a creational deity.
You were talking about the missionaries.
They got rid of all evidence. Now, what they got rid of, and we just have sort of three pieces left, was wooden oars carved with lots of little hieroglyphs. It looks similar to the Egyptian hieroglyphs, but they're not the same. It looks similar to an Indus Valley script, actually, from 3000 BC, but let's not go there. The aliens landed there, and then they landed there, and they give them the script. And what they did with this script, now this is amazing, right? So they wrote from right to left, and so they carved their symbols, and they were all like Braille. So I forget what you call it when the actual symbol sticks out, okay? And so the symbols went along a line, and then instead of going back to the beginning of the next line, they went like that. And then they went like that with the symbols. Now, there isn't an explanation for that, but I've got one. If you're in the dark on a boat in the middle of the Pacific, right, and you want to be reminded of which star to follow or which particular thing that you should be looking out for in terms of currents, that kind of stuff, then you've got it all, haven't you, on your oars. You're not carrying anything extra. You're not carrying extra weight. But in the dark, they could feel it. Now, in the dark, you try to go from one side to the next and skip a row or fine. So I thought it was a really clever way of doing it, writing. Now, there was so much history and mythology put onto those oars because that's the way that they would learn the routes. So this island, I mean, we all know how big the Pacific is. You look at a globe and half of it is blue from the sea. It's enormous, right? So how are you going to find this island 11 miles by 8 miles? But they found it. No problem at all. They never missed. They knew exactly where they were going. And it was because of the cleverness of reading the stars, or if it was cloudy, the currents, seabirds, the temperature of the sea, all this kind of thing. It was all there. Anyway, so it was all burnt. And then there were several other things as well that kind of like eliminated the population. They took slaves from the island to work on the sugar plantations wherever, or whatever plantations. The islanders fought back, but they didn't have muskets, guns, and all the other stuff that the Europeans had. They didn't have any weapons. They didn't need them. And so they were just completely overwhelmed. So there's the most awful stories about how they were, kidnapped and torn away and and everything, and the women, you know, were taken away, and then when the men had all had their fun, etc., on the boats, they just used to throw them over the side as they went on to the next island. It's you know, it's so much injustice, and a lot of injustice in terms of their sexual attitudes, which were probably quite healthy, and how they were treated with them. Now, we get that also in Hawaii, but then there are other, so Kwawa, another deity with a big story to tell about the treatment to the indigenous population. And then we even have now a dwarf planet recently named Silesia. So Silesia was an Italian name, and she was a goddess of the sea. Okay, so there she is, goddess of the sea, that's fine. So the Romans look across and they see that, whoa, you know, they've got, you know, a really big sea god Poseidon. Or, guys, this is massive. Okay, we better have a sea god. So instead of promoting Silesia and saying our sea goddess, they take Neptune, who was actually just the god of inland water and fields and horses, and they promoted over Silesia, and he's now the god of the sea.
Oh, interesting. I never knew that.
Yeah. So even little stories like that just tell the tale of injustice to minorities.
Right.
And so there's Mike Brown just Googling away as he discovers planets. And, oh, I like that story and I like this name and everything. He also gave us something. So what we've got on the left-hand side here is the far left is the sun. You've got a little glow in the corner there. And the first planet, these are orbits. The lines going down are orbits of planets. And you can see Neptune there. And then we get to the Kuiper Belt. You can then see how we've got classical Kuiper Belt orbit. And before that, we've got a Plutino's orbit. We've got different areas of orbits for the different astronomical units from the sun, distance from the sun, and different sort of groups of planets. And then, you know, there's like 10 astronomical units in between them, and then there's another group. So Mike Brown gave us something quite, I thought, quite important, but I don't know why he did it. He said, I want everything in this group to be, the Plutinos, to be named after mythological characters from the underworld. And then I want all the planets discovered in this group, the classical KBOs, Kuiper Belt objects, I want them all to be given the names of creational gods or goddesses. Now, why he came up with that, I don't know. I wasn't in touch with him anymore after that. But I thought, wow, that's amazing. It was, you know, he really had a vision or was in touch with a kind of a more spiritual, if you like,
yeah,
look than and approach than you get in lots of astronomers. So.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you find the dwarf planets more interesting than, for example, Mars. So how much weight do you feel these dwarf planets have? I know that's just a term, compared to other planets in the realm of cultural astronomy and astrology.
As far as cultural astronomy is concerned, then, so that's in the here and now. So in modern times, in 2024, the effect of the sky on the earth below, on the population below, I think there are interesting beliefs out there in terms of Planet X, let's say, or, you know, the coming of the new Messiah or whatever else. It's all interesting stuff, you know, who knows anyway, who's to say that it isn't going to. So, and I think these, I suppose they're off grid, you know, they're off mainstream, they're fringe subjects. And I think each in its way has value because at the end of the day, we're looking at the sky. The trouble is everybody looks at a television now and nobody goes out and sleeps under the stars anymore in a metal bed with stilts with the animals underneath. So we have lost touch with the sky completely. We have streetlights. We tuned out of the heavens and into technology and Xboxes. And so cultural astronomy now only reaches people through an Xbox game, which happens to be about spacemen shooting other spacemen or something like that. Star Trek, Stargate, that kind of stuff, you know, all of that is cultural astronomically led. There is so much more to discover. There is so much more complexity. It's resonating with issues of now. So, for instance, Mackie, right? If so, we could look at population decline on his island. Let's take that. And we can look at migrating populations also. You know, the Portuguese, the French, the Spanish, the English were all invading other parts of the world. We could say that, hey, you know, this is an issue. This is a strong issue. Just look at the displaced people in Syria. Just look at the displaced people at just over the Turkish border. You know, it's an in-your-face, right-now issue, the displacement of population. And we could look at other things, like, for instance, Salacia, right? You know, so that, you know, promote the man over the woman. You know, this is current stuff being discussed. And so I think that there is a place for these to remind us of history and use that knowledge and information to think about how and what we're doing now and maybe put some thought into it. I think these planets have been carefully named by a chap who really thought about it, and I think therefore it's down to us to think about these names, look at the history, and therefore behave better or act like we've learnt something in the interim years.
Because these names also reflect stories and mythology, not in the sense that something isn't true, but mythology in that it can speak to the deepest parts of our own souls and psyche.
Absolutely. We would be so much less were we to take away our mythological inheritance. I mean, well, for instance, Xbox would struggle to find some themes, wouldn't it? I mean, even Arthurian, you know, legend, there are those who believe that one of the constellations in the sky, the one that looks like a soldier, there's like three dots for his belt, it's like he's smiting. There are theories to do with, you know, that image inciting stories about, you know, this strong king who fought. Was it connected with the Arthurian legend? If we didn't have these myths and these fantastic stories, we would be so colourless. We would, you know, how would we manage without something to tell children? How would we manage that something to read? How we wouldn't have fantasy. We wouldn't have Stargate, Star Trek, and, you know, and Merlin, you know, all these other great programs. Clearly, we do need to have that kind of history and that gift that gives us something for the imagination and something for thought and process.
Yeah, and to help us maybe even guide us in our lives and to help us have more meaning, purpose, joy, better relationships, or whatever we're looking for in life that's important to us.
We could certainly learn a few things about international relations, couldn't we?
Yeah. Since you are an astrologer as well, can you share what configurations or what the planets or heavens are sharing with us as a reflection of what you indicated about how many people are watching television, maybe staring at their phones a lot? We're grateful they're listening to this conversation. But to be able to pop out and maybe be more in touch with nature and culture and so forth, are there any configurations that indicate what's happening now in relationship to that?
The discovery of the dwarf planets, as far as I'm concerned, it takes us out of our box, whatever your box is, and introduces into something bigger. Talking astrologically, I think that they indicate that we will be talking to aliens or alien entities or entities, extraterrestrials, whatever you want to call it, very soon. I mean, certainly by 2026, something like that, I think that there is some kind of communication going on.
Well, many would say that they are already having communication with other beings.
Maybe it just becomes mainstream rather than hidden. And I think space travel and another population movement, right? So instead of populations moving across Europe and out of Africa and over to the Americas, population moving out of the solar system. I thought what was really cool was it was muted probably about 10 years ago, that Haumea would be a great landing place for us to set up shop before we leave the solar system, because it's rocky and it has water. If we look at the planets that we had got before the Kuiper Belt planets, so the last one is Neptune. These are all gas giants. We can't land on them. We just go straight through. So to have the Kuiper Belt there and to have those rocky planets, things that are solid, means that we've got a landing place before we then head on out into the galaxy. And so just things like that really, for me, make sense. Even if you say, oh, astrology, well, yeah, okay, then it's up to them. I've met so many people who say they don't believe in astrology, but I've never met anybody who studied astrology and still says, I don't believe in astrology. I think what people ought to do is study it before they speak, which is what I did. I have a master's in cultural astronomy, so at least I took the trouble to go and learn something about it before I started to pontificate. But anyway, there is an enormous amount of resonance and synchronicity between relevant things in our solar system. I think there is an invisible three-dimensional web, like a spider's web, which is probably electromagnetic in nature, and has resonance like a noodle soup, right? And I think that all happens in the quantum realm, rather with string theory, for instance. So that sort of makes everything relevant. So you do something on the surface of Pluto, there is a tiny, infinitesimal little traveling along the cobweb, which eventually filters down through the atmosphere and finishes up in our local electromagnetic environment. But you don't have to believe that. But actually, go and look at some quantum physics and you'll see that actually we already have that heavily theorized by the equations that they're doing now.
Yeah. Well, there's a fair amount of research in parapsychology that shows that psychic phenomena and interconnectedness is real. And even Einstein talked about spooky action at a distance. People talking refer to it sometimes as non-local consciousness, but really it's, you know, we're able to understand and sometimes experience people's thoughts, emotions across thousands of miles. People have been visited by a loved one who just died when they didn't know, they hadn't received a phone call or any other forms of communication. So absolutely, we definitely explore a lot of these topics on New Thinking Aloud. And I just, before we wrap up, last week we had a beautiful display in the sky with a solar eclipse. And I was just wondering if you have any insights into the meaning of that particular solar eclipse. It seemed to bring many people together in a beautiful way.
It's happened across the axis from the zodiac signs. This is not the constellations. The constellation star patterns have the same names as the zodiac signs, but they're not the same thing. So it happened across the zodiac axis of Aries, Libra, which in astrology is always about the world of me versus, or the world of one versus the world of two. So I think for most people, what it represented, apart from the people that actually got to see it, so for the rest of the world, it probably in their lives represented issues to do with partners, partnerships, that kind of stuff. So that's I think, probably what it meant. Very interested to see spaceweather.com today. They did some measurements during that eclipse, and they now have a pattern for a Doppler shift effect, which was recorded during that eclipse. So they've got the stuff, which if you go and have a look at the graphs, will show a clear disturbance in both light and sound waves and wavelength.
Wow. What do you make of that? Because, I mean, clearly this isn't the only eclipse that happens. There are eclipses happen.
Yeah, between 4 and 6 a year.
Yeah.
So that happens every time. There is always a disturbance on the ionosphere, and cosmic rays are getting in because the sun's rays are not knocking them out. They have a massive effect.
Like on our consciousness in many ways.
Because at the end of the day, without electricity, our bodies wouldn't work. Every single cell in our body has a little tiny electrical pulse. And we are in an electrical universe. Electricity is something that is part of our makeup. And so when there's electrical tiny vibrations out there, yeah, we pick them up. I think we're probably the only animals on this planet who don't use them or register them. I mean, you know, animals that migrate, even slugs and snails, you know, use the electromagnetic environment, beetles, just so.
The tides of the ocean.
Pulled by the moon. Yeah. So that's gravitational. We've got gravitational corridors, which are different to electromagnetic radiation. We have yet to work out how the two interact, because according to, of course, the standard model, they don't. They don't.
But they probably do.
Somehow.
Exactly. Allison, thank you so much for all that you've shared today about cultural astronomy. You've given us all a lot to think about. Is there anything else you want to share today?
I hope everybody was interested. I hope our listener was interested in this. I never get a chance to speak like this about this subject. So for me, it's been a huge thrill to have a platform and just talk about these things. Normally people want to know, I'm an Aries, when's my boyfriend coming back? It's lovely to be able to just talk about the things that I find fascinating behind the scenes.
Awesome. Well, I also hope we can have more conversations, because I know you have a lot more to share as well.
Yeah, we could do a whole program on the dwarf planets if there's enough interest. So, dear listener, can you put in the comments, I'm interested in the dwarf planets, and then maybe we'll get some airtime.
Thank you so much for being with me, Allison. And for those of you watching or listening, thank you for being with us. You are the reason that we are here.
2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ celebrating his 90th birthday.